students go out. That particular spring, David had decided to rest on his laurels instead of going out to battle. This shepherd become king was only 30 years old when he began to reign over Israel. Back then, David and his men marched into Jerusalem against the Jebusites and declared it to be the city of David. The Philistines were next to fall. David and his army carried the Ark of God, God's mobile dwelling place, into David's city, with David himself dancing and leaping before the Lord. His military prowess unassailable. David then makes a move to solidify his regime by domesticating God, offering God a permanent residence in David's city in exchange for God's favor. God declines the offer and instead makes a promise to David. God promises to never remove God's steadfast love from David. It is a promise that establishes David's house, David's dynasty, David's kingdom forever. A promise that means to root and ground David and Israel in the love that never ends. Well, sometime afterward, we read, David attacked the Philistines and subdued them, then the Moabites, then the Arameans, the Ammonites, and the Edomites. Sprinkled throughout the text are press releases. The Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. And David won a name for himself. And David reigned over all of Israel. And David administered justice and equity to all his people. Just before we meet David today in our text, David wages a battle of massive proportions in which David killed 700 chariot teams and 4,000 horsemen, and the commander of the Aramean army. Finally, when all the kings saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel. Therefore, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David remained in Jerusalem, to bed the life of one of his generals. Why am I telling you all this? Maybe because the times have made me a cynical reader of David's story. According to Walter Brueggemann, I mean almost 3 decades ago, God's promise to David is a statement with partisan political commitments that establish not only a theological idea, but a particular form of political power. That is to say, God's unconditional promise to David lives very close to self-serving ideology. And, says Brueggemann, may be heard as an act of royal propaganda. Particular power arrangements that benefit some at the expense of others are now legitimated and guaranteed to perpetuity by the promise of God. It is almost impossible to sort out in this passage what is genuine faith and what is self-serving propaganda. But, Brueggemann says, recognition of this ambiguity can help us discern as well that various theological claims in our time are heavily laden shifted the theological foundations of Israel. Hereafter, the actions of David or Israel are not decisive alone. That is to say, King David could do anything. Could send for, play with, and impregnate the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And then have Uriah killed in battle to preserve his reputation. David could do anything without jeopardizing God's unconditional love for him and without losing the people's unconditional support of him. I'm telling you this because in this time, when self-serving ideologies were heavily laden with theological claims, our own response to God's unconditional love in Jesus Christ is at stake day by day. One response is to use the promise of unconditional love to justify moral license. Moral licensing, I learned this week, is a particularly interesting mental glitch. When something helps to strengthen our positive self-image, it also makes us less worried about the consequences of immoral behavior. If I am known as an advocate for women's rights, I can be forgiven my infidelities. A champion for racial justice, the least racist person you know, and racial stereotypes are neither here nor there. Given this first response, God becomes a God who is in the business of giving mulligans to God's servants. Yet it seems to me that this line of reason only reliably follows if you also occupy a place of power and privilege. If you are a King David, or Wesley Moonves, a president or a medium, but also a preacher, a restaurateur, office manager, doctoral advisor, it is the powerful and privileged, in large arenas and small, who believe themselves to be so above reproach that they may help themselves, pleasure themselves, satisfy themselves at will, and at the expense of insignificant others without ultimate consequence. Moral licentiousness is one response to unconditional love. The second response has to do with God's unconditional love of the other, the immigrant, the poor, the person of color. Causing such a cry fell a double down on the Deuteronomist's theological meritocracy. Only if you do thus and so will you then be deserving of God's love. It is a response that leads me to Mr. Rogers. Fox News in 2007, 4 years after Mr. Rogers died, called Fred Rogers an evil man and blamed him for creating a generation of empowered narcissists. Instead of telling the Greeks that he liked them just the way they were, one commentator said, "We should have been told, the world owes you nothing. You have to work and compete. If you want to be special, you have to prove it." Recalling this critique in the light of the current documentary, convinced of the world that they were the worthy, even worthless, maybe losers. And I think it was no coincidence that they were precisely the ones who encountered in Jesus the length and breadth and height and depth of love from which they were made. Fred Rogers spent his life rooting and grounding the lives of children in the love that never quits, never gives up, never ends. During seminary, he had watched children's programs that demeaned the other, through lies in children's faces to humiliate them and respond to difference with verbal violence rather than kindness. My mother would not let me watch a Howdy Doody show for that very reason. Using puppets rather than a pulpit, Fred preached a message of inherent worth and unconditional lovability to young viewers about our purpose. He believed that the space between the television and the viewer was holy ground. Believed he could use television for the broadcasting of grace through the land. Before entering his office each day, his Presbyterian minister would pray, "Dear God, let some word that is heard be yours." In 1998, Esquire reported the story of a young viewer with an acute case of autism. The child had never spoken a word until one day he uttered, "X the Owl," which was the name of one of Mr. Rogers' favorite puppets. The same child had never looked his father in the eye until the day his father said to him, "Let's go to the neighborhood of make-believe." And from that day forward, the little boy began speaking and reading. Later in Roger's life, he told the story of a child who was being terribly abused by his biological parents. From watching Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, the child began to hope that there were kind people in the world, and became convinced that he too should be treated with respect. The child called an abuse hotline and was rescued. If the story doesn't seem exceptional enough, consider that the hotline operator who answered the phone that day adopted the little boy. The response of astonishing humility. In the third place, a life of grace and gratitude is the morally significant response of all who in Jesus Christ are being rooted and grounded in love. I pray, therefore, in this meeting time, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have the power to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know those